You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today is Wednesday, May 25th, 2022. I want to remind everybody again that I have my merchandise, which should be ready by the 1st of June. I'll make sure that everything on Radio Albion, everything reflects it. Because we have some excellent designs that Jason Augustus helped me with. That should be just really in a few days. So, as always, I thank all of my donors. And the website, theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com. So, the Orthodox, all one thing, is where you could really pretty much do anything. My website is still up. That's no problem there. I will be updating it shortly. And of course, the Patreon page, which really is a big deal for me. All of these are things you can do and ways to not just support me, but get your hands on more things that I've done, especially the books. I also want to, speaking of books, I want to make a point to say that my book on nominalism, The Ontology of Death, is complete. There's a few minor tweaks in there, a few things, the bibliography and, you know, like that have to be done. But overwhelmingly, the body of the book is finished. And I will let you know when, finally, after 13 years, that's going to hit the shelves and where you can get it. And I'll make sure everybody knows in great detail. Into something that I spend a lot of time on. It's not an easy book. It's a book connecting metaphysics, philosophy, and theology all at the same time, treating the Church Fathers as philosophical figures primarily. Of course, they were theologians, but as far as nominalism concerns, this is a metaphysical question, ontological question, really. We spent 2 weeks talking about, with a very dense work known as the Philosophy of Mind, or the Philosophy of Spirit. I'm sorry, the Phenomenology of Spirit by Hegel. And I'm done with that sort of thing for now, which may come as a big relief to a lot of you. And we're going to do something more specific to what I'm known for here today. And it's something that's been asked of me for a very long time. And either I keep forgetting about it, or I just don't have the right enough information where I could be satisfied to do this for an hour. And that is the Varangian Guard. This is something that I know so many of our people are very interested in. And like everything else, it's enshrouded in mythology. But at least some of the basics of this are beyond dispute. What their role was, who they were, and its connection with the Orthodox Empire in general, I have not dealt with on this show. And that's going to be the topic for today. And one of the reasons I want to do it is that it revolves around, at least initially, around my favorite Byzantine Emperor Basil II, who brought the empire to its greatest extent and created an economic powerhouse, an overflowing treasury, with a great degree of social equality, in a non-capitalist, a more or less command system based on agriculture, with usury at an absolute minimum, that's very possible. You can't have any kind of even basic equity with compound interest. When the interest rate is controlled, money then gets put not so much into debt repayment, but into productive enterprise. and the Varangian Guard, and I don't want people to think that these were all Vikings. The term doesn't necessarily refer to Vikings as such, but it is a Northern European term referring to people who row. Actually, there's a number of theories as to what that word actually means. It's not at all obvious, but it has to do with seafaring men, somewhat adventurous seafaring men. It was a basically multi-ethnic unit, but they most certainly all came from Northern Europe. Of course, they can't be too multi-ethnic because they have to communicate one with another. But at least in Byzantium, they were looked at as eccentricities because of their size. The red hair, the blonde hair, which was not normal for people in Southern Europe, and certainly amongst the Greeks. This guard became the core of the Byzantine army, became the core of everything concerning security of the Byzantine state. Basil II ruled right at the cusp of the second millennium. And he was facing a rebellion by, the best way to put it is the old military aristocracy of Anatolia. This is in 988. So Basil II is kind of easy to situate because it's right at the turn of the millennium. But he found himself in trouble. This is relatively early in his reign. And the rebels that he was facing were well off and well led. Now, there were numerous treaties connecting Kiev with Constantinople. And most of them had something to do with the connection of trade concessions on the one hand with military service on the other. And the Emperor Basil took advantage of this. Saint Vladimir of Kiev, one of the greatest saints in the calendar, wanted to do two things. He wanted to remove relatively unruly, both Slavic and Nordic, Finnic, people from Novgorod, this general vicinity, out of the area, and he had trouble paying them in the first place. And on the other hand, of course, he was bound by treaty. And doing a huge favor for someone like Basil II would solidify himself as a supreme ruler in the area. That's exactly what happened. This group, about 3,000 men, maybe a little more, came down to Constantinople, became the core of the Varangian Guard. They destroyed the forces of the aristocracy in one night, and in roughly 30 days, the entire rebellion in Anatolia was destroyed. That, among several other things, reinvigorated the empire, which had been in a state of decadence for some time. Basil II is one of these rulers who, by himself, was able to reinvigorate and replenish an empire that was on the verge of falling to pieces. Nothing destroys, the Roman Empire, whether it be the West or the East, is on the verge of destruction, usually when civil war breaks out. Or civil war breaks out when the empire is on the verge of destruction. Either way, it's a terrible sign. But they fascinated people. They were fascinating. It's not like they were totally unknown in Southern Europe, since you had regular trade from the Nordic countries straight down to Dnieper, emptying out into the Black Sea and everywhere in between, including Novgorod. This was the artery that connected Eastern Europe and put it all, stitched it all together. This was initially to the east in the Volga. That movement was also enriching of the Khazar Empire, which was more or less fallen apart by this time, but only very recently. This was a slightly different route, but anyone who was able to protect the Dnieper stretch, especially as it came to the Black Sea, was going to do very well. And this is one of the sources of St. Vladimir's finances, and it also was the source of the first Varangian Guard development into Constantinople. Nevertheless, they were very different from everyone they came across. Greeks are relatively short statured. They're dark hair, dark eyes. And the Varangians were overwhelmingly taller, more muscular, and their hair color was either red or blonde. And you had all colors, but those two, you know, you didn't have a lot of redheads down there. And they terrified people, they fascinated people, but Basil II, being who he was well aware that this was exactly the ingredient that he needed, not only to reinvigorate the empire, but to regain respect for the holy city itself and the crown. That kind of respect, that kind of image, was essential to how the crown operated. Contrary to some belief, the Varangian Guard only existed for about 400 years. As they began to lose battles, roughly around the time of the Fourth Crusade, you don't really hear much from them ever again. But the Anatolian aristocracy who they fought was a well-put-together force. No one was expecting their methods. No one was expecting their weaponry. No one was expecting any of that. And they made short work of it. Now, the Byzantine army, I've dealt with at least once or twice in my writings over the years, and the Temne system, or the theme system, really had three elements under Basil II. The one that I've made a big deal about over the years, I was at the Barnes Review especially, was the thematic armies. This was an innovation of the Byzantine Empire. The root was communal land, substantial land, and labor in exchange for military service. This meant that the agricultural communes were generally based on equality, the taxpaying was usually on time, and the treasury was not involved in paying the army. These were professionals, but they were not necessarily full-time. This was the bulk of the army. One of their advantages, not just because it didn't cost any, but in fact they made money off of it, was that they had a very flexible muster. The teams were specific geographically and under a specific leadership. They can be called on one by one or all together. So it not only was this the core of the military service, but also was a huge part of the agricultural output of the country. And that's a big deal in an area that doesn't have a lot of arable land. And with this, in this context where Basil II forced wealthy landowners to pay the taxes of those who are much poorer, that's what happens when you have a strong central power. That's the point of smashing the Elatolian aristocracy and bringing the Varangian Guard to be able to do that. Because this became an oligarchy. And in smashing not just their military force, but their ideology, was central. And of course, the Varangians were at the center. So the Varangian Guard was connected with the person of the emperor. It had no other connection. They were paid several ways, we'll get to in a minute, but it was a personal connection with the emperor himself. The second level is what I guess you could call a more or less professional army. They were not necessarily landowners. And as far as the thematic armies are concerned, it's a very good idea to have your soldiers, especially your elite soldiers, being landowners. They have things to defend. They have things to worry about. They have a direct stake in the system. I've argued in the past that the Theme system is one of the reasons that Byzantium lasted as long as it did. Whenever the oligarchy took over, which it almost did here, the Themes came under attack, and many of them began to decay, and one family or another would take over and create a local strongman dictatorship. You still had, within this professional force, though, there were fewer in number. The professional army was fewer in number. But it did make up some of the basic manpower. It also included elite guard regiments. And these are families, the aristocratic families who either were or claimed to be descendants of old Roman families. Sometimes they could be oligarchs, sometimes they could be aristocrats. We all know those are opposites, but unfortunately they're counterparts. After that, you had mercenaries. And under Basil II, it was a relatively new thing. Part of the reason for this is, given the military aristocratic rebellion that caused Basil to go to Vladimir in the first place, he wasn't sure of regular Greek-speaking infantry and their leaders, who wasn't quite certain of their loyalty after this. So not only, and these are Orthodox people, by the way, the Varangians had their own church. Talk about that in a minute. But mercenaries were a form, it was a check on the rest of the military services, because they were a personal bodyguard of the emperor and were not of Greek background. Unfortunately, Basil was very worried, and as he grew in power, the aristocracy got more and more upset. And he established the Heteri, or Heterai, which is the umbrella organization and bureaucracy that oversaw all mercenaries from all over the world. Mercenaries, as Machiavelli said, only work when they are very well taken care of, when they have a culture that is very honor-bound and duty-bound, where loyalty, like in Northern Europe, was at a premium. Loyalty is always going to be at a premium when you don't have bureaucratic institutions. This was Basil's empire right now. And what they all seem to do around the world when they reach a level of centralization is to ensure that this centralization is going to continue even after they're gone. And the Heterai was one just example of this. And the Varangians were very well taken care of. They had tremendous loyalty to Orthodoxy, especially the memory of St. Olaf of Norway, which is what their main church was named after. By the way, someone worth talking about some other time. And so they had a treaty bound, they had a loyalty bound, they had a religion form of bondage to the emperor. They were royalists in every stretch of the imagination, which was made easier when they were paid very well. And the first main force of mercenaries that Byzantium ever used were these very same Varangians. And the way that they arrived, of course, was through the Dnieper, right into the Black Sea. And the rise of Kievan Rus, on the one hand, is what gave rise to their introduction to Southern Europe, then on the other. But they knew of each other indirectly for some time. And as I mentioned, there were three main treaties, roughly at the, 9th and 10th century treaties, because they did raid Byzantine territories on occasion. This is long before they became part of the armed services. But the 874 treaty is where they connected the requirement of military service in exchange for essentially free trade. It became much easier to work with the Byzantine forces in a legal level than in a raiding level. Raiding lines are simply not sustainable, especially against a place like Byzantium. No one could ever penetrate the walls. And then 907, and then 911. Again, mercenary service is more tightly connected to trading concessions. So right off the bat, the Varangian Guard, whether it be Slavic or Nordic or some combination of the two, were connected with trading rights, fishing rights, and general trade, and a tremendous trade. Remember, these guys coming from Northern Europe, especially they're Finnic, they're from either West or East Scandinavia, have never seen wealth like this before. They had never seen, they come from a relatively primitive, very simple community in Northern Europe that did not amass the wealth that they saw in Constantinople. No one had ever seen this before. They meet the emperor for the first time, and he's on this huge lion-shaped throne that goes up in the air with smoke everywhere. You know, these mechanisms they had in the palace that was meant to impress simple people. The wealth, the gold, the ivory, the uniforms, the silk, everything, which they had never seen, where it was completely stultifying to them from the very beginning. So right off the bat, as they were introduced to the life of Constantinople, they were extremely impressed. And since they were both Orthodox at the time, there was an immediate connection between them. So 988, the conversion of Russia to Orthodoxy, and even more than that, the marriage of Anna, Basil's sister, to St. Vladimir. He had to put away his concubines, which he did. As we all know the story of St. Vladimir. He didn't see the pagan life as really ideologically sustainable or even profitable for any length of time. It unified that part of Europe with Constantinople. That was the standard, not whether it be military or economic, it was a standard of civilization. And this initial force was between 3,000 and 6,000 men. Chroniclers say somewhere in between. But by marrying his sister to St. Vladimir, the throne in Kiev became Roman. This was the origin, the very origin of what would later in Moscow be the Third Rome. Numerous members of the Byzantine royal house would marry either Kievan or Muscovite royals. The best known, of course, other than this one, being Ivan III. And we dealt with that a few weeks ago. So there's no question as to the Roman nature of both the Kievan state and the Muscovite one much later on. So this meant this was a watershed event in civilization. This is a watershed event for the church. This created what we now essentially know as Eastern Europe. So after the Anatolians were defeated, Basil realized that this is a force that frightens everybody. They're well disciplined. And on the other hand, the Varangians were just as taken aback by the wealth and civilization and the literacy of Constantinople. So you had this mutual wonder, this mutual fascination based on mutual benefit, mutual profit. Again, the Varangians did come from numerous places. It's not like they all came from Norway or Sweden. And on the way from Northern Europe to the Black Sea, they're meeting many others, especially Slavs. Constantinople became a Mikligurd in the Nordic language. And most of us know who Harald Hardrada is, which is, we don't really have a lot of time to get into him now. He was leader of the Varangian Guard from roughly 1033 to 1042. And typical, he became a very wealthy man. The so-called officer corps of the Varangian Guard always did very well, but even the lowest rank did very well in that particular in that unit. They did better than the regular army did. The trade between Northern Europe and now in Constantinople, the massive amount of gold that was going north was even destabilizing the Norwegian economy, and of course Harald will eventually take it. But before then, news of what was happening in Constantinople slowly moved north. In fact, maybe quickly moved north, which could only mean that you had young Northern Europeans of various types who say there's one almost guaranteed way to become wealthy. It's to get on a boat, go down the Dnieper, and become a part of this system. Now, very much like this is, I'm willing to say, maybe the first concept of special forces in the history of the West, in the history of Europe. And that's how they were treated, and that's how they were expected to perform. So you had a population drain from Northern Europe, and then, of course, they return after their service is over. And they return far wealthier, far more sophisticated, educated in the best of Roman military tactics. And this is someone like Harald is going to be able to destabilize the whole system. The Nordics who moved south and lived there for a while and did their service down there come back head and shoulders in every way to those who stayed behind. And it changed Norway forever, of course. So, and so the route from Scandinavian countries, if they were going to start that north, that far north, into Novgorod, the wealthiest city, eventually became the wealthiest city in Russia, down the Dnieper, right into the Black Sea. Now, the way that the non-Greek ethnic units behaved, they were separate and they were autonomous. In essence, they became the bodyguard of the emperor, but they did have different functions as this influx of warriors from Northern Europe increased. And there were three types over the next few generations. It was the sailing guard, the, for lack of a better phrase, the mercenary guard, and the Varangian guard of the city. And that's almost their rank in terms of importance. The sailing Varangian guard were the first, I think the West Romans had a Marine Corps. They were knowledgeable in amphibious landing. But this became the Varangian Marine Corps. They functioned as an amphibious force. They also functioned as a coast guard. And many of you are aware of the problem of piracy, which, you know, on the sea, of course, these are seafaring men to begin with. Taking a pirate ship or even a pirate flotilla meant a lot of money for these guys. And they were allowed, and the loot, you sack an area, you destroy a ship, something like that. The loot that you were able to take, and pirate ships only have, that's what they're there for. There's a very specific division of the spoils. Eventually, Harald Hardrada actually got into a lot of trouble in Byzantium for disobeying that one time. They were not going to let these guys get out of control. And they were too loyal for that anyway. But we'll talk about in a minute just exactly how they ended and on what grounds they ended. So the Coast Guard, the Varangian sailors, kept a huge portion of the plunder. And in exchange, of course, they kept the empire safe from pirates, which was always a huge problem in the Mediterranean at the time. The mercenary guard was, for lack of a better phrase, the rank and file. They did garrison duty throughout the city and in key points of the empire, especially weak points of the empire. They were the first to be sent to the front. This was a shock corps. Amongst all the units of the Varangian Guard, this is the one where the loyalty became a level of fanaticism. Their plunder and the profit that they were able to make was extremely high. The mercenary guard was the first, at least on land, the first group of people who had a right to loot an area, an enemy area. Again, that was subject to law, but they had the first right to do this within very specific circumstances. And so these were the shock troops out in the field. And finally, the guard of the city. This was the highest, most elite rank. This was, to be more specific, the bodyguard, the personal bodyguard of the emperor. And by the way, other than the loot itself, they, especially the guards of the city, were paid directly by the emperor's personal money. The Varangian Guard proper, when we use the word guard, we really are referring to the guard of the city. This was to replace and to be a much better version of the Roman Praetorian Guard. We all know what the Praetorian Guard was capable of in Western Rome, and to a great extent, their very destructive role. Basil, and at least some of his successors, were aware of this history. We're not going to permit that to happen here. Like Machiavelli says, if you want that to happen, you have to take care of these guys. At the same time, you have to be an emperor that is to be respected. The Varangian Guard built its tradition on Basil II. I've said 100 times in many contexts in the past that Basil II is one of the key figures, maybe even the key figure in the Middle Ages. Without him, I'm not sure what would have happened to Byzantium. It could have descended into like an early modern Poland version of the oligarchy. Every single member of the city guard was wealthy, personally wealthy. Now, looting was less for the city guard because they had bodyguard police-style duties, unlike the first two versions. However, their salary was between 30 and 40 gold pieces a month, which then was enormous. This is about 30 times the normal pay of not only the average laborer, but the average soldier. They were automatically, the very act of being accepted here, the very act of passing the various tests you had to go through to become a member of this, it was automatic wealth. And this is one of the things that brought so many of these guys down from Northern Europe. Once they hear, and it wasn't an exaggeration, It wasn't like the American, you know, paved streets paved with gold nonsense. This was actual. In fact, they didn't really have the language to describe what Constantinople was. No city was even close to it in terms of wealth. When they were used against a rebel force, or when they were used in battle, their percentage of the loot that they were allowed was about 33%. And again, that was maintained very, very strictly. Now, when a new emperor was crowned, one of the first things he did was give usually a very large bonus to the guard around him. Their loyalty was pretty much assured. It wasn't entirely based on their income, but it certainly didn't hurt it. And even to some extent, I think this may be exaggerated a little bit, but to some extent, they were allowed, and just them, they were allowed to raid the old emperor's accounts, especially if there was a hostile turnover of power. So you're a young man in Norway, you're a young man in Novgorod, wherever. This is a dream job. This is what all of these guys wanted to be. It was built right into the sagas of the day. They sang about this stuff. This became a part of the culture. It's like someone from the Bronx always wanting to get to Manhattan and being able to afford to live there. These jobs in the city were highly sought after. And especially once Harald went back to Norway after a tremendous career. I mean, the guy was on like 30 campaigns, a lot of them against the Arabs. I mean, that man alone, to think that, you know, he deserved and earned the wealth that he achieved. Most of these guys, in fact, earned the wealth that they achieved, despite the fact that they were given a huge reward. That also implies that a lot was expected of them. It was pretty rare to be a member of this guard, I don't care where you were stationed, and not to be a comparatively wealthy man. You're wealthy even by Byzantine standards. Then you take that and you go back to Norway? It's almost becoming a divinity. And this explains Harald Hardrada's earlier career. Now, later in Great Britain is a different story. But in that first, you know, larger part of his career, his ability to finance all this stuff made a lot of sense. Now, Selos, Michael Selos, someone who I normally consider or use mostly as a philosophical source, was also a historian, and he spent quite a bit of time describing this. He's a contemporary of most of the events that we're talking about here, and his description of them, and really it's a lot of what we know about the early era, their early era, is really from him. Again, this is a very literate society. And the first thing that he notes is that they are of enormous stature. And, of course, blue eyes, sometimes gray eyes. And that they have a fighting spirit that's not even human. They fight with a ferocity that's not undisciplined. They also wore tattoos. Turns out this is more of a Turkish custom. But the tattoos themselves were something that freaked out all their opponents. They had never seen anything like this. They used the basic chainmail, usually very short, and they had a helmet and the typical rounded shield, which is going to change as time goes on. And the shape of the shield is actually pretty important. The weaponry at the time, and then it got better in terms of quality, and it changed a little bit. The spear, axe, and the sword. The sword was definitely a tertiary weapon. We all know them for one thing, though, and that is the two-handed axe. This was the Northern European weapon of choice. Very, very hard to defend against. And when you're of tremendous physical strength to begin with, there's simply no way to resist it. And it's not just the physical damage that it does, but also the psychological fear. You know, I used to lecture in the Middle Ages in various universities, and I noted that, you know, they created the notion of physical fitness, because usually the longboats, they weren't just left on the shore, they were carried. This was the case later on in Great Britain and elsewhere. And so these guys were actually, you know, lifting and carrying these things, sometimes full of plunder from wherever they go, then back right onto the water again, which means that even though they're bigger than everybody else, they became more muscular than everyone else. They had to have noticed at some point that this has something to do with their endurance and their strength. This was a very early form of physical fitness. And with the diet, which was to a great extent fish-based, they were extremely healthy. But as time went on, they took on, the Byzantine weapons were, of course, superior. The Byzantine weapons were the far superior to anywhere other than maybe China. And as they became wealthier, they developed their own kind of half Nordic, half Byzantine weaponry. Their mail tended to get longer, down to the knees rather than down to the waist. And the technology was pretty high, where it could be very strong without being overly heavy, which was kind of a big deal if you're on the water. And the shields got bigger, but they also looked like the very famous, the round shield was the older one. The shield that looked like a kite with a point on the bottom became not only a defensive weapon, but an offensive weapon if you used two hands with it. And the quality got better and better as time went on. Not only are you in a technologically advanced society, but you have the money. These were not issued by any state agency. These were things that you were responsible for. And as they became more experienced, the shields were heavier and bigger. And with a point on the bottom, it became a deadly weapon in and of itself. The Greek sword was adopted a bit later. Once it reached the quality, both one-handed and two-handed, that they were satisfied with. And of course, they had nothing like this in Northern Europe at the time. And the weapon that they developed while in service in Constantinople was the pole arm. I've seen examples of these. They're kind of all over the place. It's a spear with a curved blade at the end of it. And it had a million different designs. Very heavy, extremely well made, almost unbreakable. But you take all of this together, and it was their appearance that created a psychological terror and confusion long before they ever touched anybody. After the death of Basil and his immediate successors, the guard went into a brief decline because they were strictly at the disposal of the emperor as a personal connection. As an instrument in his hand, unlike the army, which had an aristocratic layer in between. Whenever the emperor became less and less respectable, which was certainly the case afterwards, the guard got smaller and smaller. A weak, vacillating emperor is going to be threatened by them and reliant on more pliable forces. After the death of Basil, the sources get thinner as to what they were doing. Still, throughout all of this, their top commander had a very specific title, and it's a Greek word, and it means the man behind the emperor. In other words, this was the force that made the emperor what he was, at least in the physical realm. In fact, when you had a competent emperor there, the second man became sort of a vice president. He didn't have any policy importance because policy didn't mean the same thing as it does now. But then after Basil, he became the commander of not just the guard, but of all mercenary forces, no matter where they came from. That office was abolished in 1204. We all know what happened in 1204 when the Byzantine Empire was sacked by the Crusaders, and the guard suffered along with everybody else. And no matter what unit you were connected to. There was the specific religious fraternity dedicated to St. Olaf, and that was their own Orthodox church, and they brought it wherever they went. Right down the street from Hagia Sophia was Our Lady of the Varangians, which essentially was their cathedral. Some of you may be noticing that there seems to be a bit of a parallel with the Cossacks here. Of course, that parallel was very incomplete. The Cossacks weren't the force behind the emperor, at least, and had no legislative position. But the Cossack Church functioned in the same way that this did. But it is proper to have a Our Lady of the Varangians icon, and their cathedral was right was very close to Hagia Sophia, showing again their importance not just militarily, but religiously too. Now, I don't know, and I've never come across any of the sources, any sort of resentment between the two, between regular forces on the one hand, especially the aristocratic clans, and the Varangians on the other hand. The distinction seems to be, really no more so than between special forces and regular forces, between a Navy SEAL or the SAS and the regular forces on the other. But because the garrison forces, the guard of the city, was used in police and security duties, it was very easy not to count them necessarily as a military force. They were a paramilitary force. But the garrison service, as time went on, and many of these men became Greekified, Hellenized, I should say. They married into Greek families. And the same thing they did in the Slavic world. And they slowly were integrated into regular forces, because they were always, and it's like the Marines in America, they were always the first to go and the last to come back. As time went on, they simply became an elite, no doubt, but not radically separate from regular military formations. Now, unlike in democratic states, where a legislator or a president declares war and then runs in the other direction, the emperor normally would accompany his men into battle. An emperor really wasn't an emperor unless he also was a competent general. And of course, they all had military training. So whenever they went out into the field, the guard was always very close to him physically. And there was a few times where the emperor in field got into a lot of trouble. At the same time, while the emperor was away, they were security for any imperial property. Basic police duties as well in terms of the city. You had what we could call law enforcement, although that concept is strictly a modern one. It's not like you had prisons in the Middle Ages. You had reformatories like in monasteries. But when there were high-profile captives or high-profile hostages, which is a common way of securing treaties and agreements, they were the ones in charge of guarding them. This is where the emperor's enemies were kept. And again, this is as much of a psychological matter as it is a physical matter. That you didn't have a lot of escapes. An escape would mean disgrace. Now, it's not in the sources. I can only assume that's the case. And not with the respect that they were given everywhere. They had no incentive. Even when the emperor, as the emperor began, the emperors post-Basil emperors were, less respectable. However, the Komnene dynasty did save them. And as they went into decline, and never turned on the emperor, it doesn't matter what he was, never turned on him, but they would fade as the emperor got weaker. But that dynasty did save them from oblivion. The downside, of course, to all of this was that for the most part, if you were to put in your 20 years, whatever it was at the time, and go back to Northern Europe, you were one of the lucky ones. It's important to note that being special forces, both on the land and on the sea, meant that, again, first to go, the last to come back, but also the first to die. An enemy would key and focus its initial round of fire on the guard. They had a distinctive appearance and a distinctive uniform, and that was not difficult to do. Especially in battles in the field, I mean, as a part, you know, being a security detail for the emperor, they were, we would call, heavy infantry. And that also implied that they were always kept in very close formation. Their formation discipline was extraordinary. The whole notion, people use the phrase shock troops all the time. It was similar to the idea of Blitzkrieg. You have a line of horsemen or infantry. Shock troop are to move very, very quickly and punch a hole. No different than, you know, the defensive line in football. You punch a hole in it, thereby splitting the army in two parts. That had a lot of dangers attached to it. But poking holes and splitting the forces of the enemy was their really number one tactic, and that's what they specialized in the field. When you combine that with horse archers, or archery in general, softening up the forces before they did this, it was incredibly effective. Still, though, post-Basel, its sources remain pretty scanty. A lot of this is alluded to without being stated explicitly. In the realm of, or the era of Basil II, just for example, as far as the psychology of all of this is concerned, in 989, as I mentioned, 1 year after the deal with St. Vladimir, the rival, the oligarchic leader, Phokas, was not just defeated and humiliated, but he was hacked to pieces. And that has a lot to do with a ritual killing more than anything else. Hacking them to pieces not only shows a tremendous lack of respect, but the ferocity was meant to put the psychological fear into everyone they came across. And they were known for this. Selous and many other writers at the time went into great detail as to what they were capable of in the field. This wasn't random, though. This wasn't wild abandon. They simply weren't capable of that. Right up until 999, they were used extensively against the Fatimid units. That is the Fatimid movements in Islam and in the Arab world. They may be best known. Again, we're going back to Basel, which is where the sources are the best, for their assistance in the defeat of the Bulgarian Empire. So not only are we talking about the greatest expanse of Byzantium, Constantinople under Basil, but the way it was done was sheer military discipline. The guard, once they showed up and became a regular part of the military force, you know, the Bulgarian Empire had been a huge problem for Byzantium to the north for some time. One of Basil's titles is the Bulgar Slayer, and there's a very good reason for that. In a decade-long campaign, that was the end of the Bulgarian Empire. And it was in 1014 where the remnants of that empire were finally defeated. And that's the source, and the Varangians are the reason, where the 99-100 scenario took place, where for every 100 Bulgarian soldiers captured, 99 were blinded, and the one with sight left, I mean, he had one eye left, was to bring them back home to let everyone know that this is what's going to happen if they reform again. And that was the end of the Bulgarian War. And that's where Basil II gets his nickname. And this is why this was the greatest expanse of the Byzantine Empire, because this is the part of the Balkans that Byzantium had not quite conquered yet. And there was a vacuum where certain Slavic tribes were able to form, you know, the tremendously competent Bulgarian rulers prior to this. Facing west, in 1018, the Lombards were defeated, which were huge rivals of the Byzantine Empire in that direction. But 1025 is when Basil II died. And again, going back to Michael Selous, the policies that Basil is known for, and the reason why he's my favorite of all the Byzantine emperors, came from the force that the Varangian Guard was able to regularly and effectively put out. Destroying the feudal landowners was his main, well, outside of protecting the borders, was his main internal priority. This was going to destroy the empire. Oligarchy destroys anything it touches. This is why the aristocracy had to be destroyed, and that's why bringing the guard in was so extremely important. And even he couldn't have foreseen exactly how important it was going to be. A building of social bonds, be on the patriotic or religious lines, could only be done if these huge differences in wealth and class were to be overcome. No one complained about the wealth of the Varangian Guard, given the fact that they had to work very hard to get it. These were not nobles who didn't do anything. They, you know, drove the empire as far as Crimea, Georgia, Armenia, in every direction, north, south, east, and west. The guard was extremely active. And it took a very long time before anyone had an answer for them. Again, after Basil, it was a pretty much continuing decline. There were some exceptions, the Comnenus dynasty, of course, but not only the guard declined, but the army itself declined. His immediate successors took a massively overflowing treasury and spent the empire into oblivion without the income, without the highly talented bureaucrats that these emperors were able to hire. And there was never an instance of the Varangian Guard not supporting the interests of the Byzantine state. In 400 years, there's not a single instance of it. However, there is one instance of the guard turning on an emperor, which is extremely rare. But it was Michael V. This was one of these, you know, rotten emperors that came afterwards. And he was trying to kill the Patriarch, who, of course, another a politically important figure. Given that extreme situation, Varangian Guard stopped him. And in 1042, castrated him. With this line of very poor rulers, you have, you probably all know, the Manzikert disaster in 1071. This was the first time the Varangians and the regular lead forces of the Byzantine army were defeated in huge numbers in the most humiliating possible circumstances. This is what happens when you see a decline of leadership after the death of Basil II. The fact that they had to castrate Michael and to have this very, you know, rulers in quick succession with different factions of the oligarchy supporting them. There simply weren't enough guards to keep every faction in check. There, again, sources can be iffy, but there's no example of them being bribed or manipulated into fighting an emperor. It's really hard to bribe people who were paid that much, and even the worst emperors knew that they had to keep them happy. After that, needless to say, you had the bane of the Roman Empire, and that was that civil war. Now, I've mentioned that the Comnenus dynasty had saved this. They had arrested the decline, not just of the guard, but the army and the empire as a whole. The Varangian Guard was rebuilt, and the sources now are more substantial, because it wasn't so much from the Scandinavian world that the Varangian Guard came from, now with the Anglo-Saxons. And this is, and I mean that explicitly, the racial group, the ethnic group. These are the Anglo-Saxons that fled the genocidal and destructive invasion of William, the infamous 1066 battle. Britain, of course, was never the same again, and the Anglo-Saxon communal system was replaced by the military oligarchy of William. The Anglo-Saxons had already been decimated by Knut, and now yet again decimated by William and his successors. The Anglo-Saxon, with very experienced military forces fleeing the country, went to Byzantium. This is the connection. of Britain and the Orthodox world. This is the connection of, I mean, you know, they were Orthodox up until William's invasion. In fact, the Orthodox Church has thousands of saints from there. This was a non-papal, I mean, it was, they didn't believe in papal domination. They certainly had the consecration, but William had a very different point of view. Now, despite not really listening to the Pope, the papal ideology was imposed on Britain through William. There's one source that says there were 5,000 Anglo-Saxons that arrived at one time right after this. However, the Normans continued to push east. The Normans, you know, took Sicily, and Alexios Komnenos in 1081 had to face a substantial Norman invasion. Remember, of course, Normans, although they were from that part of France, a very tightly knit, very well-run state. Norman, of course, is another word for Norseman. This was in the early Middle Ages, Vikings were invincible in Western Europe. The old Roman martial arts were gone. The only way to fight Vikings is to tame a faction of the Vikings and settle them in Normandy, which is exactly what happened. This is your classic top-down feudal state in its most pure form. And it was small and extremely well-run, and this is what gave them the ability to invade successfully an already broken Anglo-Saxon aristocracy. Of course, this didn't really help them, but the Norman invasion was as substantial as Normandy itself. The Varangian Guard used its, again, there was contempt on both sides. There was no loyalty among Vikings whatsoever. But the shock troop method, bursting a hole through their line in this shadow, this massive shadow of arrows, was initially very successful. They lose the battle, Durazzo and elsewhere, because they pushed too deep. They pushed too deeply. And very quickly were they surrounded. I'm not 100% sure if this wasn't expected, but they pushed too deeply, and the sheer number of men that they were able to put out meant that they were surrounded. They were overexposed. Normans eventually took their target. The emperor was wounded, and this is the second major defeat of the Varangian Guard. And that was the end of the Komnenos dynasty, of rebuilding of the system. The third defeat, I think, is going to be clear. I've already alluded to the Crusades. You know, initially, the first three were very poorly organized, were very poorly run. They didn't understand the Arabic threat the way the Byzantines did. The Byzantines had a huge intelligence apparatus that the Westerners had no idea. They were attacking friendly Arab forces that were quite willing to fight for the Byzantine Empire, even though they were Islamic. They had no idea about this, and come crashing in like a bull in a china shop. At the same time, they did give Byzantium a certain a breathing space. And the papal states, the Crusader states, places like Antioch, were such a drain on Western Europe, they simply didn't have the resources to maintain them. And with a weakened Byzantium after 1204, they were unsustainable completely. The Varangian Guard fought on the walls of Constantinople during the Fourth Crusade and were eventually defeated. That was their third and final major defeat, and they went into a steep decline after that. The last time we hear them is in 1259, 1258, and as the empire had fallen apart, and Nicaea was the successor empire, which I have at least one or two lectures on. They were on escort duty. The emperor there was Epirus and Nicaea were the two successor empires of Byzantium. They will eventually retake the city and throw the Latins out, but the last time we hear them in any reliable source is that they clearly accepted the emperor of Nicaea, as is proper, as the true successor of Byzantium, unlike Epirus, who was not. And they eventually became Catholics. The Empire of Nicaea, the Varangian Guard had been reformed on a limited basis, and they were on escort duty. And that was it. After that, the Varangian guard goes silent. They seem to have faded away. And we're not heard from again. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.